This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost. Joining me in the studio is editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their financial website of the year. And today, it's all about the brown stuff. Love it or hate it, from cars to our favourite pot of yeast extract spread.
Dove antiperspirant.
Marmite at breakfast.
Our most indulgent magnum.
Tesco. Every little helps.
Yes, this week a public spat between Tesco and Unilever over price rises caused panic that many of our favourite branded goods may disappear from supermarket shelves. Unilever said it was the result of the falling pound. A deal was reached. Marmageddon may be toast. But for how long?
This really impacts the entire industry. Tesco being the biggest retailer in the UK and Unilever the biggest supplier to Tesco, this was really setting the benchmark for what the impact of Brexit will be.
We investigate the winners and the losers of the fall in the value of sterling. Was it overpriced in the first place, though?
Perhaps it is going back towards a more sensible long-run value, but that doesn't really do anything to help us out in the short term.
Also today, the scythes are out at Lloyd's.
The banking sector is under a lot of pressure at the moment. You know, income is currently declining. It's going down further and further due to the record low interest rates.
Another round of job cuts as they announce cuts as well to their popular current account. They aren't alone in what's a big blow to switchers and savers.
I think what's happened is a lot of these banks, they've been running these great deals for a few years now. They've attracted some new customers and they're thinking, we really don't want to spend any more money on this.
Also today, we talk to who else but Sarah Beeny as we get mixed reports about house prices. They're falling. Nope, hang on, they're rising. I don't know. Does anybody?
Everyone is making assumptions based on more or less information from the past. So my assumption would be that house prices will go up in the next 20 years.
And brown is back. No, not Marmite on the supermarket shelves, but cars. Brown cars. But we are asking today, I want to know quite simply, how wedded are you to brands? Simon, a very good morning. A very good morning, Lee.
Morning. Good morning.
Are you happy just going for the bog standard supermarket own brand, Simon, or does it really depend on what you're buying?
It depends on what I'm buying. And I would say that the one thing that I can think of that I would not accept the supermarket brand or the inferior Australian version of is Marmite.
Oh.
Marmite does not taste the same if you eat the non-Marmite supermarket brand version, and Vegemite does not taste the same as Marmite. I know some people argue that it does, but it doesn't. And I would not accept a Marmite substitute. I would either have Marmite or I would have nothing.
Simon, I feel like I've let you down. I feel like there was a taste test. I should have foreseen this, and I feel terrible. I've let you down because I've never tried Vegemite, I think it's called. I've only gone with the traditional one. I think that's the problem for me. Lee, for you?
I a bit the same as Simon, actually. In terms of Marmite, I'd happily have Tesco yeast, whatever they call it. I'm sure it'd be fine. Yeah. But I'm more of a Bovril man anyway. Bovril's far nicer than Marmite. As spread on toast.
It is.
I'm telling you, it's absolutely delicious. But it's also owned by Unilever, so I mean, it wouldn't have made any difference. But there are some things. Definitely, I would never get own brand bread, for example. I always find that tastes a bit nasty. It goes a little bit, I don't know.
Really?
Supermarket cola. Oh, God. Even the thought of it makes me go a bit, ugh.
I don't know what it says about me. I'm quite happy going for supermarket own brands of any food stuff. But if it's anything like that I put on my face...
You've been lured in by the packaging, Georgie,
so
the glossy packaging.
I would most stuff, I would go, okay, I'll buy the supermarket version if I think it's as good. But there is some stuff that isn't as good. So I would say ketchup. Heinz ketchup basically tastes much better than supermarket owned ketchup. Daddy's sauce or HP sauce, supermarket owned brand brown sauce does not taste anywhere near as good. So yeah, there are things that I wouldn't buy, and I don't think supermarket cornflakes taste as good as Kellogg's cornflakes either.
You're the second person to say that today, Simon. There's something in that. I'm still shaking my head that I missed a trick here. I really did. I missed a trick. I'm sorry. All I can do is I just apologise.
Consuming Issues with Georgie Frost. Weekdays from 9 till 12. Wants your feedback. Contact the programme by tweeting at Share Radio UK. Text 66777 and start the text with the word share. Or email consumingissues@shareradio.co.uk. If it's about money and it matters to you, it matters to us.
I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from the financial website of the year. This Is Money. You are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NS&I. I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to go through some of the stories they've been looking at this week. And we will land, first of all, as we've seen the pound continue to fall, as it has done since the Brexit vote, but it really hit home to shoppers this week with, yes, Marmite Gate. Twitter went mad at the thought we may see such favourites as Hellmann's Mayonnaise, Ben & Jerry's and pot noodles disappear from the supermarket shelves.
Dove antiperspirant.
Marmite at breakfast. Our most indulgent magnum.
Tesco. Every little helps.
The fact that it's in the open, I would argue, is because it really impacts the entire industry. Tesco being the biggest retailer in the UK and Unilever the biggest supplier to Tesco, they were the perfect two gorillas to have a good fight with each other. This was really setting the benchmark for what the impact of Brexit will be.
And that was former Tesco supply chain director Bruno Montaigne there. Well, George McDonald is from the magazine Retail Week.
You can see it from both sides, and there's always argy-bargy between retailers and suppliers, like there is between any buyer and seller. But from the point of view of Tesco, they've had a lot of problems over the last few years. They're making a comeback now, but one of the things they cannot afford to do is pass prices on to their shoppers. So I think they've drawn a bit of a line in the sand. From the Unilever point of view, you know, they are facing higher prices because of the decline in sterling. This is a very volatile time, but there have been volatile times before, and retailers and suppliers both love to talk about how they collaborate to the benefit of the consumer. So let's see them do that rather than take more out of the shopper's purse. There's all sorts of factors that will come into play, but one is where the ingredients come from. It might be made here, but it might be using all sorts of stuff that's bought from other countries. Also, you know, quite a wide range of products are involved here, so I'm not sure whether some are more affected than others, and Unilever is just trying to, you know, balance out the total impact. But the whole supermarket industry, indeed the whole retail industry, will be watching, as will all the suppliers. This is probably the first of quite a few similar showdowns.
The Marmite battle may be toast, but is the war over? So, to consumer affairs editor Lee Bovril Boyce. I'm glad you like that one. It took a while to get out there. Lee, what's going on here? What happened? Why was this so public? Is this usual?
Well, look, you could see whatever effects have been of Brexit, this has definitely been the biggest one that's blown up. You take Marmite away from the people.
No.
Well, imagine if this bombshell was said before the EU referendum. I think we would have ended up with a Remain vote. By the way, the way this has blown up in the press yesterday, it was absolutely unbelievable. What, I mean, what a great PR for Marmite. There's videos of Marmite going around Twitter. Everyone is just eating Marmite. I'll tell you what, it's not been a bad bit of advertising for Unilever, is it? But in a nutshell, what's happened is sterling's falling. Unilever, a European company, even though Marmite's made in Burton, they're saying that, you know, it's going to just fall in sterling, it's hitting their profits, etc., etc. They needed to pass on a 10% price rise in the cost of its products to go into Tesco. Now, we don't know how that's gone down with other supermarkets. There wasn't much other mention other than Tesco, so maybe some other supermarkets have just swallowed it and accepted it. But Tesco, to its credit, you know, they're in a massive supermarket price war right now. You know, you've got the German discounters, you've got all the other supermarkets that are having to try and fight to keep prices low and get people coming back in, week out. And it just turned around and simply said, we're not passing these costs on to our shoppers. And it just, a bit of a row, a bit of a storm in a teacup. And here we go. Now, lo and behold, within 24 hours, they sorted it out yesterday afternoon. We can all eat Marmite at the same price. And it's going to be back on the shelves. You know, so many Tesco stores are running out. Even though you could have probably got it in any other store. It's always floating around in, like, corner shops. You know, it lasts forever, doesn't it? So I don't think we were in any serious danger of actually running out of Marmite. But I did like some of the responses yesterday. People saying that we were going to have to, you know, the sterling's just going to disappear. We're just going to be trading in Marmite jars, which I quite like.
There's an idea for you. I mean, you say it's a good PR for Marmite, which certainly we've probably mentioned it about 1,500 times already so far in this show.
Exactly.
But also for Tesco as well. I mean, just reading the Mail, focusing on the chief exec, who it calls drastic Dave Lewis. The bruising boss of Tesco has a reputation for standing up to price war bullies, says the Mail's city editor Alex Brummer. His defiance resulted in a hugely welcome victory for people power. That would be the same Dave Lewis that used to work at Unilever, is that right?
Yes, that's right. True. And Tesco will be delighted to be seen to be fighting the consumer's corner here and on the right side of a pricing battle with some suppliers, because Tesco famously ended up on the wrong side of all kinds of pricing shenanigans with its suppliers, with its accounting black hole, and then it emerged the things that go on about charging suppliers extra money to get on certain parts of the shelves and into certain parts of the shops. The supermarkets have come in for an awful lot of criticism surrounding the 3-for-2s and the bog-offs and you know, these accusations of confusion pricing. So Tesco will be absolutely delighted to be seen to be on the side of the man in the street who wants to put Marmite on their toast, or woman. Mm. What's interesting is that Unilever, as an Anglo-Dutch company, has been accused of trying to take advantage here. So the pound has fallen. The pound's down this week as well. And it will make things more expensive. But Unilever had tried to impose this across-the-board 10% price rise on all its products. And as Lee said, Tesco said, no, we're not accepting that.
Do we actually know the ins and outs of the deal, though?
Yeah. In terms of what's gone on, well, they just said we're not accepting that.
They may have accepted a 9%.
Well, they might
have
done. Yeah, but they said we're not accepting that because basically we don't think it's fair. And also, then, you know, Marmite was a great example because Marmite is made in the UK with largely UK ingredients. There's some debate as to exactly how much of those ingredients come from the UK, but there is no reason why the price of Marmite theoretically should go up. Although I will tell you that the price of Marmite is notoriously volatile.
Explain, Simon.
Well, if we cast our mind back just over 2 years, or nearly 3 years, This Is Money actually covered the mystery price of Marmite movements. So basically, I have a story here, 7th of February 2014, Marmite lovers hit as the price of their beloved big glass jars rockets 50% in just 5 months. The mysterious rollercoaster ride of the cost of a jar of Marmite has continued, with its price rocketing 50% in just 5 months. Last September, that would be September 2013, This Is Money revealed how the price of the iconic 500-gram glass jar had plunged to £3, compared with its peak of £5 in 2010. Now the price has soared back up to hit £4.50, justifying our warning that Marmite lovers should act fast on hints that the price could be about to rise. And we did quite a bit of investigation into this. However, the good news, the good news for Marmite lovers, other than the fact that Tesco is on your side, is that I have just done a search on my supermarket, which compares the cost of that 500 gram iconic glass jar of Marmite, and do you know what it costs at the moment across Asda, Morrisons, Waitrose and Ocado?
Well, assuming the front cover of the Daily Mail is right, the free giant jar of Marmite, is it worth £4.50?
It is worth £4.50 at Iceland, but it's telling me that it's £4 at some of these other shops. So actually, that price of Marmite is lower than it was 2 years ago.
Marmite deflation.
Well, as I said, this price
seems to move around. Forget oil prices, forget sterling. It's all about Marmite.
This price seems to move around quite a lot. I mean, we have covered this in the past, and actually, if I'm going to be honest, we've covered so many things in the past that I had kind of forgotten about this story until a certain Mr. Lee Boyce reminded me of it yesterday afternoon as Marmageddon had us in its grips.
Dear Unilever, please send the cheque in the post to This Is Money and Share Radio for the amount of times we've mentioned Marmite in this segment. But I want to know, making it slightly more serious, I suppose it does show what goes on a little bit behind the scenes between suppliers and retailers. And there will be some suppliers where the falling pound will have hit them hard and they will need to raise their prices. Obviously, they won't have the clout of Unilever. Could they be slightly squished by the supermarkets?
Yes, they could. I mean, look at the supermarket power that's gone on here. It's you know, Tesco has turned around to one of the world's largest consumer brand goods companies and said, no, we are not accepting your price rise. And if you look at this from an investing perspective, people who invest in companies like Unilever, and the consumer brands companies, invest in them because they have pricing power. The argument is that these brands endure over time. You know, Marmite isn't going anywhere. Persil isn't going anywhere.
Pot noodles.
Coke isn't going anywhere. You know, all of these big brand names across lots of different companies. And the argument is that they have pricing power, and if they do need to put their prices up, they can put their prices up. And this shows that despite the beating that our supermarkets have taken over the past couple of years, they do still wield an awful amount of power. But I think what we can expect is that anything that we buy that is imported, people should expect the price probably to start going up. Or what you will see is that the price won't go up, but the amount of the product that you get in your hands.
Well, that's the thing. They should just reduce the size of the product like everybody else seems to.
So, yeah, exactly. So you're going to get shrinkflation, as we call it.
Which you've already got.
Where the price stays the same, but things get smaller. Mm. And, I mean, the pound had been trading at about $1.30, the already pretty not-so-good rate of $1.30, until the start of last week, and now it's trading at $1.22. It had been trading at the fairly rubbish rate of €1.16, €1.15, thereabouts, between there and about €1.20. And it's now trading at the more rubbish rate, if you want to buy some euros, of €1.11. So it's going to cost us more money when we want to go abroad on holiday, but it's also going to cost us more money when we try to buy things from abroad. Now, the upshot of that is that that is good news for British companies selling things abroad, but also British companies selling things made in Britain and sourced in Britain in this country, if they can still keep their prices low whilst goods from overseas are going up in price.
Earlier this week, a former governor of the Bank of England, Lord Mervyn King, says he welcomes the plummeting value of the pound.
It's not bad, though I think the economy before the referendum was slowing somewhat. And I think we are in a position where the rest of the world is not offering us much help. From that point of view, the fall in sterling is a welcome change. But the whole thing, there's generated reactions, which I think are by and large over the top. And during the referendum campaign, someone said, he said, you know, the real danger of Brexit is it will end up with higher interest rates, lower house prices and a lower exchange rate. And I thought, dream on, because that's what we've been trying to achieve for the past 3 years. And now we have a chance of getting there.
Well, we have spoken about the falling pound being bad news for shoppers, for holiday makers, taken by many, of course, to be an indication of the economic damage that Brexit may cause to the UK economy. Could it reach parity with the dollar by the end of the year, as some traders have speculated?
Trading week enters the home stretch. A torrid week for UK assets dominates sentiment. The pound firmly below $1.25 after a two-minute flash crash in Asia overnight sent the currency tumbling.
The attention of financial markets, global financial markets, right there in London with the cable rate, a three-decade low. It's sterling weakness at 127.49. There's the move down 0.7%.
Sterling is once again under the cosh, dipping briefly under $1.20.
But rewind 10 months and the consensus among analysts seemed to be that the pound was actually rather overvalued, hurting Britain's competitiveness. So why now is the fall in the value of sterling viewed as such a bad thing? Here's Alistair Kabbala of the Centre for Economics and Business Research.
It might be going back towards its equilibrium level. I mean, perhaps it is going back towards a more sensible long-run value, but that doesn't really do anything to help us out in the short term. We still have to contend with the effects of shocks. You've got a point. I mean, it probably was overvalued. But on the other hand, you want it to correct in an orderly way. You don't want to have a sudden geopolitical shock that has all sorts of other tricky effects to negotiate, and then have the pound start being super volatile. That's not the type of way in which you want to get back to a more sustainable long-run situation.
So, Simon, some really interesting views in that, I thought. Given as well that we've not triggered Article 50 yet, do you expect the value to fall further? Is it priced in already? Is it all down to negotiations? What did you make of, say, Lord Mervyn King there?
Well, Mervyn King speaks a lot of sense, and I quite like Mervyn King. And I think that, yes, he's talking about trying to get a little bit of inflation. Well, that's why interest rates are at, you know, a quarter of a percent, and we've got lots of cheap money sloshing around the place. We've been worried about low inflation, so we want a little bit of inflation back. He's talked about keeping a lid on house prices. Well, we definitely need to keep a lid on house prices. And he talked about our currency depreciating and making us more competitive on the international stage, certainly when it comes to our goods and services that we're trying to sell overseas. And yes, that is a good thing. So yes, from many people's perspective, a lower pound is a bad thing. And I think it's very rare that you find the man or woman on the street saying, yeah, I'm really delighted that the pound's fallen in value. But from an economic perspective, it can be a good thing. And then there's the question of, is it going to fall further? It's difficult to tell. So at the moment, it's pricing in the so-called hard Brexit stuff that's going on, the rhetoric that's been coming out. If that ratchets up a bit more, then yes, you could see the pound fall further. Mm. If it maintains a fairly even keel, then maybe the pound will stabilise at around this level. I think that if you see it go below $1.20 and then stay below $1.20, then you will see it fall further. You know, when you look at the markets, you tend to find that there's these important levels and you know, you get these important trading levels. And once something drops below it, it has a tendency to keep dropping for a while. So I think if you look at that 120 as a benchmark like that, then that could be an issue. Realistically, it probably is undervalued at the moment. The 10-year average exchange rate is 164 or 165, something like that. But some analysts say that the long-term trend is down and that the equilibrium rate, certainly in the light of Brexit, is considerably below that. I'm looking at our article here that Adrian Lowry had written, and it says, recent research from World Economics suggests that at 1 to 127, sterling is 13% undervalued against the dollar. But the thing about markets, about currencies, about shares, about anything like that, is stuff can stay undervalued for some time. Mm. So just because you look at it and go, oh, it's undervalued, doesn't mean it's suddenly going to bounce back up.
I know that it's got loads of implications with the value of sterling, but a lot of the time we hear, don't we, is it best to buy our holiday money now? Is it best to buy our Marmite jars now? Because it's not just at the supermarket, is it, Lee, that we're witnessing firsthand the fall in the value. I mean, this week, holidaymakers at Southampton Airport must have got a bit of a shock. They were offered a paltry 0.88 euros to the pound, a difference of 25% to the official rate compared with a typical margin of 10%, so says the foreign exchange firm FairFX. But it's a picture being repeated up and down the country. How are they getting away with that?
Well, it's always been, it's a known fact that, you know, if you get your currency at the airport, you're going to get stung. That is rule number one. Yes. When you're going on holiday and you're getting your currency. What these currency firms argue is that they have to pay for security costs of having an operation within the airport, and the cost of just having it there is a lot more than it is the high street. That's what they argue. And that's why if you ever order your currency online, you tend to get a better rate because they probably have lower overheads. Now, this time last week, I was reporting that airports, it was about 1 euro to a pound. Mm-hmm. That's fallen even further this week. So we're talking within a week, it's dropped even further. Some of these regional airports are definitely worse than they are in London. So Southampton, Southend, Luton, Birmingham, Edinburgh, they all seem to have slightly worse rates than your Heathrows and
because
your
Gatwick's. Of the security, they're saying?
Well, I don't know if it's that. It might just be better availability. Maybe it's easier to get the currency into the desk. Who knows how these things actually really intricately work. But I think that, you know, if you're going on holiday, most people know not to get their currency at the airport. That is the thing, isn't it?
I mean, so we're not seeing this elsewhere. So
well, yeah,
I mean,
it's dropping.
Example,
it's dropping. Yeah,
but not as much.
I've been
this.
Keeping my eye on it. So we've got a number of travel currency desks in Kensington. I do have a look, and it has been falling all week. You know, rates are going down, and that's just the fact of what's happening at the moment. You know, they can't offer a higher rate than what's actually going on in the world and what's happening to the pound. But in terms of the airport, I mean, I think there's something really sort of hits you hard when you're getting less than a euro for your pound. When it's on parity, it's kind of weird. I remember not that long ago, you got $2 to a pound. You know, that used to be the thing. You know, you'd go to America, something would be $200. You'd think, well, that's £100. No longer. Those days aren't there anymore. And even euro was going kind of that way at one point. And now, yeah, it's gone pretty much under one for one if you're at the airport, but you can still get about €1.10 elsewhere.
So what do you think then in terms of we've got half-term holidays coming up in a couple of weeks. What would your advice be?
Well, shop around. First of all, you know, you've got to look online. You've got to see what the best rates are. If you can get it delivered ahead of time, then do that. You sometimes get a better rate. And especially if the currency keeps falling, you know, pound keeps falling like this, it might be good to lock in the rate now. I mean, seems a bit mad, but that's what's going on. Also, there's a number of currency cards that are pretty good. They tend to offer quite good rates. If you don't want to take actual physical money, you usually offer 0% withdrawals and that sort of thing. That would be my two biggest bits of advice. But one thing I would say is don't be expecting to be getting some sort of supersonic rates. And maybe a lot of people do keep some euros floating around in drawers. I say have a dig around. See, yeah. I think I've got about 80 euros just floating around the house just from previous trips I haven't sold. Because, again, you look at the sell rates at some of these desks and the markup is extraordinary. You know, they'll pay absolute peanuts for you to get your euros back.
Well, you have, thankfully, because I just said that, I mean, it is half-term, bit of a bad news time, I suppose, for families, get more expensive. But you've been actually looking on This Is Money, how to keep costs low, but other ways. So from cheapest travel destinations to where to fly from and even on what day. Now, I thought this was a myth, but no, it makes a difference what day you travel on.
It does. When you think about it, a lot of people would be booking holiday and factoring in weekends, so they'll probably want to maximise their holiday by flying out on a Friday evening or a Saturday. So that's probably the most popular time for flights. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you fly on a sort of Monday or a Tuesday, you're probably going to be looking at cheaper flights because you're kind of cutting into a bit of a week. So it depends how flexible you can be with your work. And if it works for you, you know, do it. But the research, I think, showed 150 quid difference from booking on a Saturday compared to a Monday.
Yeah.
And also the time of day, even the time of day you look at can really factor in, because there's a lot of people searching for flights at the same time, which tends to be the weekend. It's going to drive up prices. But my number one advice would be have a UK holiday. I think.
Do you think that's any cheaper, though? I don't know. Do you think that's any cheaper?
I'm not sure it is. I'm not saying that you shouldn't holiday in the UK. I think holidaying in the UK is great. But in my experience of going to places like Cornwall or Norfolk, the cost of staying somewhere and the cost of eating out and the cost of everything else is more expensive than it is if you were to go to Europe. And you can't rely on the weather in the same way either. But then, for some people, the weather isn't so important. No, that's true.
The weather's not so great.
I think the people who this is really going to hit is people who need to. Who it's not just holiday makers, because holidaying is ultimately a discretionary choice. Mm. You can choose to go on holiday, not go on holiday, spend less money on your holiday. It's people who have to move money abroad, people with properties abroad, people sending money to families abroad, people who are earning in this country and living overseas, of which, you know, there are a number of people, and some of the people for whom it will hit is pensioners and expats living overseas. And if you are the kind of person who basically does regularly have to move money abroad, then you need to make sure that your costs are as low as possible and you're getting the best possible rate, because you can't do anything about the exchange rate that the market's given you. You can't do anything about the pound to the euro, due to you know, all these concerns about Brexit, but you can do something about your costs of moving that money. And we've got a service on the site, thisismoney.co.uk/transfer, where you can actually compare money transfer deals. You can look at the different rates the different currency brokers will give you, and you can find the best one. And that's going to make a big difference, as we've seen with all those poor people who potentially might have bought 88 cents for their pound at the airport.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSandI.com, helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
Welcome, you're listening to Share Radio. The team from the financial website of the year, This Is Money, are back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up in partnership with NSandI. And I'm joined today by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to go through some of the stories they've been looking at this week. Now, from drops to cuts, Lloyds got the scythes out this week and took it not only to their current account, but to their workforce. Another 1,200 jobs to go of the 12,000 it aims to get rid of by the end of the year. Here's Jamie Blake from ADS Securities.
They announced earlier, October 2014, quite a large cost-cutting programme. These cuts are going to be part of that. The 1,230 jobs that are being chopped, coming from a number of departments. You've got operations, retail banking, finance and risk, and marketing and customer products as well, are all going to be taking a hit. Obviously, it's no secret that the banking sector is under a lot of pressure at the moment. You know, income is currently declining, going down further and further due to the record low interest rates. So the bank, you know, they've taken a 27% hit on their share price so far this year, and I just think they're really looking at ways to reduce costs. But the labour unions, they've voiced concerns over the approach. You know, they've said that the employees who are remaining, it's not a positive outlook for them either.
And then came the news. The bank is to halve the top-tier interest rate on its Club Lloyds current account from 4% to 2%, a betrayal to switchers as it joins Halifax and TSB in following Santander's move to cut back the rate on their popular 123 account. Here's Share Radio senior analyst Ed Bauscher.
Basically, what's happened over the last few years, some of the smaller, younger banks, and indeed a couple of the bigger banks, have been trying to gain customers by offering really attractive current accounts and offering good interest rates, which, of course, has been especially attractive when interest rates on savings accounts have been so low. I think what's happened is a lot of these banks, they've been running these great deals for a few years now. They've attracted some new customers and they're thinking, we really don't want to spend any more money on this. The other issue is that the interest rates in the financial markets have fallen even further sort of over the last year or so. So the cost of these accounts have got even higher. And Santander, a little while back, cut the interest rates on their best known account. And now I think the other, the 123 accounts come down to a 1.5% interest rate. And I think this week we've seen a couple of other banks thinking, do you know what, we'll follow the lead and cut rates on ours.
And it all comes as last week the government scrapped plans to sell its remaining stake in Lloyds to members of the public, citing market volatility for the decision. So Simon, first, job cuts. The bank says the losses are necessary. They were coming anyway due to our changing banking habits and not Brexit, which rather makes a change to here. But what do you make of what's been going on at Lloyds?
Well, we've talked about this before, haven't we? Banks just need less people nowadays. There's a lot of stuff that is going online. They need less people in branches. A lot of the sales culture has been cut back on. They can't sell in the same way that they used to. And as the more people do their banking online, the less we need bank staff, because it's not just about bank branch staff. It's about all the people who might have been needed to process a transaction when you phoned up, and instead you just do it on your phone and a computer does it for you. And I mean, what it is it's a sign of an industry that's in transition. It's a sign that it's an industry that is in a way shrinking, in a sense, because it needs less people to do the same amount, and also has challenges coming at it from all different sides in terms of non-bank competitors or bank competitors from smaller challenger banks. And then I think the other thing in terms of the share sale is the government has decided that the last thing it wants is to launch a share sale where it discounts the shares to encourage small investors to buy in, and then something happens and the stock market takes a 10-20% tumble, and all of a sudden they've got a load of people who've lost a load of money on those shares. What they ideally want is people to buy the shares and then make some money. They don't maybe want them to make quite as much money as they did on the Royal Mail shares. So there was this whole question of the discount and attracting the ordinary investor in. I think ordinary investors are a bit unhappy about it, actually. And we've seen Hargreaves Lansdown, for example, speaking out about it, saying that they thought that ordinary investors were being disadvantaged. Now, the one thing I would say is that when the government announced that they were going to do this share sale and they were going to offer this discount, and there was a sort of buy five, get one free deal that was going to go on, is that Lloyds' share price, I think, was knocking around 75p. And it is now considerably lower. And a lot of people expressed an interest in buying those Lloyds shares if they were going to get a discount at the time. Well, if you think that those Lloyds shares were a good buy then and you think they're a good buy now, you've got an opportunity to go buy them from the on the stock market itself at a much bigger discount. So that's the thing that people need to weigh up. But I do think it is a bit of a shame that the last chunk of the bank isn't going to go to private investors, because private investors seem pretty keen on getting their hands on it.
Lee, I'm going to go to you on this one. Tell us more about this and the cuts across the board, because they're not the only ones to do this, are they?
I'll tell you all about this. The last couple of years, banks have made a massive play for current account customers. They're offering high interest rates. Current accounts are very attractive customers to have because you can cross-sell other products. That's why, basically, traditional savings rates, we haven't had a high street bank in our Best Buy tables for years now. It's just current accounts have become king. Now, Santander was the first to cut its rate from 3% to 1.5%. That actually kicks in November, so that's coming up quite soon. Now, what's happened this week, there's actually been four accounts that have had some big changes, and I'll run you through them all now. Lloyds, it's got a account that offers 4% if you've got between $4,000 and $5,000 into your account. So a lot of people would have played the system, would have held between $4,000 and $5,000 in there to get that 4%. Now it's just going to have one tier 2% rate up to a certain limit. So, you know, it's going to be nowhere near as attractive as it was before. You know, you can get 2% up to $5,000 on that now. It's not, it's just been halved, isn't it? So,
yeah.
You know, It really annoys me, all this sort of stuff. And then Halifax, it's reward account, £5 a month. You get paid if you've got if you trigger certain, you know, paying a certain amount of money, keep yourself out of your overdraft, etc. That's going to fall to £3.
Okay.
And TSB is cutting the rate it offers from 5% to 3%, all coming into effect in January. Mm. So, you know, that is some. Another blow to savers.
I was going to say, the reality of that, though, is if you've got, say, your TSB Classic Plus rate dropping from 5 to 3%, you're not going to get 3% anywhere else. I mean, you've got it on your website. Deposits into cash ISAs falls by 87% a year as banks and building societies cut rate to as little as 0.01%.
It's very, very true. And that is the game, isn't it? I mean, it's actually very hard to be going, I can't believe Lloyds is cutting this rate. I'm going to take my money away. But then it's gone, where do you go? Bank of Mattress, that's going to give you 0%, isn't it? And that's the thing. And also, there was one other account that, interestingly, has actually just been removed completely, which is the Norwich and Peterborough Gold account, which was very popular with travellers because it offered 0% when you went away. They've just pulled off all of their current accounts off its website, just mysteriously vanished. So, all of a sudden, this week, current accounts have had a big blow.
And yet, interestingly, while you're being discouraged to save into whatever vehicle you can in terms of your cash at the moment, recently we got Sainsbury's Bank launching their longest ever 0% balance transfer credit card of, 42 months?
Well, this is it. So, you know, you can borrow cheap, spend. And I did some research this week, but the top Best Buy easy access rate is now 1%. I mean, that is peanuts, isn't it, really? People that are going to save 10 grand are going to get next to nothing on that, and they're just going to go... Bleh.
Simon, you've been tapping away on your laptop. Times are awful for savers with a Best Buy rate at 1%, and the crunch will get worse, so how will you beat it? Your 2 minute starts now.
Well, as Lee said, the Best Buy savings rate is now 1%. I mean, that's astonishing. Like, we've looked at savings rates that people just hoped couldn't go any lower over the past few years. And that optimism has proved to be wildly misplaced. I mean, I looked at some figures here, and in August 2012, the Best Buy Easy Access account paid 3.2%. And I can tell you that people were grumbling about that then. I was grumbling about that. Today, it pays 1%. And that line in the sand 4 years ago is important, because that's when Funding for Lending was launched. Funding for Lending gave cheap money to banks and building societies in order to pass it on to borrowers, and effectively killed their demand for savers' cash. And rates just stepped down. You look at the chart that I've published, if you look at the table, it just goes chuk, 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 and ratchets down all the time. And then obviously things got worse when the Bank of England cut rates after Brexit at the start of August. And so now we're down to that 1%. But savers actually, ironically, despite how bad it looks, it's not been quite as bad as it seems, because in August 2014 something else important happened, and that's that inflation fell to match the Best Buy savings rate at the time of 1.5%. And since then, inflation has been below it. So it means that people have been earning a real return on their money after inflation. Now, that's the way of the world. That's how things should be happening. But unfortunately, since the financial crisis, you can't guarantee that's going to be the case. Now, the problem is that savings rate line is moving in a downwards direction, and that inflation line, as evidenced by Marmageddon, is moving in the upwards direction. And at some point in the near future, those two lines are going to cross, and we're going to find that people are no longer getting a real return on their money in an instant access savings account. And also the current account game's being hacked back on. As we said, that's been the way people have been trying to combat this. And I wrote in my column that I'd like to tell you some good news here, but I'm struggling to think of any, basically. I could tell you that you could go invest in an income investment trust, get a nice solid dividend of 4%, choose a dividend hero who've raised their dividends every year for the last 40, 50 years, can hold some money back in the good times to help pay in the bad, to go for a cheap ETF or a tracker, maybe to go put a little bit of your money that you could afford to take a punt on in a peer-to-peer investment. All of those will get you a higher return. But the fact of the matter is that there are people out there who do not want to do that. They simply do not want to take that risk. And yeah, they're passing up higher returns, but they're also not taking the risk of seeing their money fall in value in the short term, which potentially it could if you invest it. And I don't think that those people should have to be pushed into those places in order to get a real return on their money. I think that, you know, I don't think it does the economy any good. I don't think it does people's, I don't think it does sentiment any good.
We're saying the only game in town is investing.
Yeah, you're saying the only game in town is investing, and but there's loads of people saying, I don't want to do it. Now, we can try and educate them as much as we possibly can as to why that's a good idea, why over the long term it pays off, why if you look at the Barclays Equity Gilt Study, it'll show you over the last 20 years, the real return on equities, which is shares in normal person's language, has been 4.5%. So that's 4.5% above inflation. The real return on cash has been 1.1%. But people just don't want to do that. And we're forcing people into it. And it, or what we're doing really is we're not forcing that many people into it. Most people just aren't doing it at all. Yeah. They're just earning no money on earning no return on their money. And I don't think it's doing the economy or people much good whatsoever. So I said to people, have you got any bright ideas on how to beat the savings crunch? You know, if you do, tell us. And actually, unfortunately, our comments were relatively short on bright ideas. So
not
it
so
looks
many.
Like nobody's found some magic bullet to get around this.
Well, this leads us on some, because you've been looking at fund managers, haven't you? Five future fund stars. And where to put your money, because, of course, with all this turbulence and not a lot of return, it's appealing to, if you can, get someone else perhaps to look after your money and do it all for you. But you've been also going a bit deeper, investigating, indeed, what makes a star fund manager, the likes of Neil Woodford, who I assume you would suggest is the ultimate star fund manager. But why? What makes a good fund manager? Are they worth it?
What makes a good fund manager is consistent, good returns that outperform what you could get from just investing in the market itself via a cheap tracker and keeping your costs down that way. Now, the problem is that it is notoriously difficult to spot these people in advance. It's relatively easy to see them with the benefit of hindsight. However, there's also quite a lot of debate as to exactly how long you need to be beating the market for to prove that you do actually have the ability to beat the market, i.e. 5 years, that's not enough. 10 years, that's not enough. I remember some study. I'm going to pull a number out of the air here, but it was talking about like 10. It's talking about 20 to 30 years of it. Mm. That's a person's entire career. And unfortunately, you can only see that in the rearview mirror. You can't see that at the start of their career. But what you can do is you can evaluate some of these people and say, what are they doing? What are they marking out here? What's their plan? And I think that my big thing has always been you need to look for someone who has a plan. They can explain what their plan is simply to you and why they think it should work. And if they can't explain it simply and you can't understand it, then just put them to one side. They might be a good fund manager, but you only want people who you can understand what they're talking about and that they can relate to you in a normal way. You want people who are acting in your best interest. So you want them to be talking about what they can do for their investors, why they care about their investors, not why they care about bonuses to buy big houses in Surrey and Porsches. And you want them to have a strategy and to be willing to stick to that strategy, but also to be willing to change things and do things, you know, when change needs to come. And also you probably want them to be having a commitment to the shares that they're buying. That means they're not over-trading all the time and seeing these transaction costs eating into them. So anyway, what you also want is the kind of research that some of these DIY investing platforms do into the managers, but into managers who haven't been around that long. And what they don't tend to do is tip managers as like the ones to invest in who haven't been doing it for a very long time. They like to see a really long track record. But what our colleagues on Moneymail, what Paul Thomas, my colleague on Moneymail, has got hold of is a combination of information from the DIY investing platforms about the ones to watch.
So do go on and take a look at that on This Is Money. But
yeah, thisismoney.co.uk/investing. You'll find it there.
Absolutely right. But property, some people may think about investing in property or indeed living in it, for goodness sakes. But never been far from the news agenda post and indeed pre-referendum vote. Now, a new study is showing home buyer demand is on the up for the first time since March. According to the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors, house prices are up everywhere except London, the North East and Wales. That said, new research from IHS Market is showing the big biggest quarterly fall in 5 years, with property in Northern Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Yorkshire and Humber, the North and the North West still below levels reached before the financial crisis. So what's going on? Here's Simon Rubinson, Chief Economist at RICS.
We've had a fairly challenging spring and summer. The tax increases first off, and then obviously the build-up to the referendum vote and the vote, you know, coming out perhaps slightly differently from what many people expected. So there's been a lot of sort of uncertainty running through the market. This is the first month since February where our key indicator tracking buyer inquiries has shown an increase. So that is suggesting that there's perhaps a little bit more sort of comfort in the market. I wouldn't say it's that people are feeling that, you know, back to where perhaps where they were at the back end of last year. I mean, there's still some uncertainty there, but there's certainly a slightly better tone to it. And that's also reflected in the sort of our indicator for agreed sales. Now, agreed sales have been falling, or sales transactions have been falling for a number of months. And we've now seen the last 2 months that pattern stabilizing. It's no longer falling. So I would interpret this as this being a slightly more encouraging survey. Key indicators suggesting that the market is settling down again after sort of what was a challenging spring summer.
Well, here's property expert Sarah Beeney with her crystal ball talking to us a little earlier.
Everyone is making assumptions based on more or less information from the past that they have. So my assumption would be that house prices will go up in the next 20 years. How much? I think regionally it'll be different. I think London will continue to go up. You know, it is a city that lots of people want to go and work in because there's lots of opportunities. Even with Brexit, I think people will still come to this country and they will want to invest in this country and they will still work in this country. However, I think, you know, there'll be other cities in the UK that will go up, but others will go up slower perhaps. But in 20 years' time, I suspect all houses in this country will be worth more than they are now.
So Lee, what's the picture at the moment? And you can look into your crystal ball if you like.
Well, the RICS research is saying that demand's gone up actually since March. And I think a big reason for that is after Brexit, actually house prices have remained relatively flat. There wasn't a massive crash. So I think people are going, well, it's not a bad time to still buy property if you can, because mortgage rates are so low. And that's the thing. People really want to try and get onto the property ladder at the moment because mortgage rates are low. That said, that IHS research that you just mentioned there showed that house prices are down 0.5% since June. That's a pretty small, you know, that's almost a sort of level, isn't it? I mean, it's nothing like in the financial crisis, there was quarters where house prices were dropping almost 6%. I mean, that's when people were really scared to get their fingers burned. So
there's all regional disparity as well.
There's a lot of regional disparity. I mean, in Northern Ireland, house prices are still down massively compared to pre-crisis peak. But then you look at London and they've completely boomed. And that's just the nature of it sometimes. And do I want to look into my crystal ball and start making predictions of what I think is going to happen in the next 20 years? I don't think so. But it's just an interesting time. And there's so many reports, and at the moment, there is a lot of, you know, some saying it's going up, some it's going down. I'm going to tell you, with the Lee Boyce Index, I think since June, it's just been quite flat. I don't think house prices have gone soaring. They've not gone, you know, down much. It's just remained pretty flat. And people know about these low mortgage rates probably more than ever before, and they're thinking, I want to get into property to live.
Well, fair enough. Right, Lee, Simon, we started with the brown stuff, so let's end on it. Paint, though, this time, not Marmite. So red, silver, blue, some common favourite car colours, but brown? How very retro. Simon, what's going on here?
Yes, back to the 70s, hey? It's the era of the brown Ford Cortina. No, brown is rocketing up the charts of car colours. It is now the 10th most popular car. And according to DVLA data, 169,656 of the nation's 30.5 million licensed cars are brown. So that's not really very many of them. But it's enough to push it into 10th place. But we have revealed the most popular car colours.
Yep, go for it.
Would you like a chart rundown? Mm-hmm. So in at number 10, we have brown. In at number 9, but falling down the list, we have yellow.
Ooh.
Number
yellow.
8.
Punchy.
Again, like brown, a little bit maybe bland, a little bit Marmite, a little bit do you, don't you like it, but it's a non-mover, and that is beige stroke buff.
Ooh. Buff. Interesting.
Buff. 7.
I feel like I need some music. I've let you down twice.
At 7, falling down the charts, 30% down compared to 3 years ago, we have green. Number 6, white has rocketed up the charts. And in fact, if we were looking at the most popular colours for brand new cars, We would have white at the top of our list, but of all cars on the road, white is just number 6. 5, we have red. Red was up among the top 3 most popular car colours not that long ago. And then we have grey. Yes, but some cars do look pretty good in grey, and grey is pretty trendy.
Grey is not silver, is it?
Grey is not silver.
No.
Silver will be making an appearance in this chart. Grey is particularly loved by luxury car brands, and there is a colour that you can get called matte grey, which is very popular on things like Porsches. Number 3... we've gone a little bit more colourful here, and we have blue. Make up 18.7% of all the motors on the road in the UK today. At number 2,
getting
the
tense,
most popular
Simon,
new car
tense.
Colour back in 2010, a colour that actually is now sold much less than white, but because it was so popular for so long, there are still many of them on the road. Nearly 6 million, 13% up on the same time 3 years ago, black. And number 1... a total of 6,841,315 of these cars are on the road, according to DVLA, and that is the silver lining
silver.
To this story.
Boom.
Silver.
Fantastic. From silver to the golden boys, editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.